want to welcome everybody again to another episode of the Blue Banter Podcast, a podcast where we're striving to introduce the members of the RPCNA to the pastors of the RPCNA and to serve young and aspiring pastors by gleaning wisdom from men with ministry experience. I am one of your co-hosts with a faulty voice today, Joe Smith, pastor of Westminster Reformed Presbyterian Church out in Westminster, Colorado.
My name is Aaron Murray, pastor of Marion Reformed Presbyterian Church in Marion, Indiana, the promised land of the North. And our guest today is Jonathan Haney, pastor of Glinda Reformed Presbyterian Church. Jonathan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys. Yeah. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
All right, well... We're happy to have you on here, and we appreciate your patience with me in particular behind the scenes with some of the problems that I've had. But we're here now, and we're ready to get rolling. If you've listened in the past, you know that we generally end the podcast with a mystery question. We've been doing two mystery questions. What Joe and I decided to do is we decided to kind of reverse it a little bit and start with the fun mystery question, then get into the real meat of the questions, and then end with a theological mystery question. So you are the first one that we're asking this new round of fun mystery questions, and I ask it for a reason to you. It's something that I've often wondered, and I wonder if any other pastors wonder this. But here's the first mystery question. How many calories do you think you burn when you preach a sermon on the Lord's Day?
You know, that's actually a very good question.
Thank you, Jonathan. Joe's over here mocking me, laughing at me.
I mean, I have no idea. I've never thought of it in terms of calories, but I do know that I'm usually exhausted at the end of the worship service. So, you know, even though I'm kind of a numbers guy, I'm not a calorie counting guy. I should be. So I can't really give you an answer. I'll just say that I agree with the premise of the question that it's an exhausting and demanding work, of the whole person. And I don't think people really realize that until you're doing it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, so for sure.
I guess my answer would be a lot.
Yeah. So the way I figure it, if you can trust treadmill calorie counters, which I don't think you can, but that's what I'm basing my guess off of, you know, it takes, if you put it on 3 miles per hour, it takes you about 20 minutes to walk a mile, and that puts you at around 70 to 80 calories. So if you're preaching for 45 minutes to an hour, let's just assume you're not necessarily static, as in you're locked into the pulpit, but you're walking around, you're talking and everything. My guess is the average pastor would probably be burning around 150 to 180 calories per sermon. Does that track with you guys?
I'd say that's sound reasoning.
Joe, what do you think? You're the fitness guy, not me.
We'll go with it. That'll be our standard for now.
All right. Well, thank you for indulging my curiosity here. We'll get into the actual questions that actually matter. One of the things that is unique about you that we haven't necessarily had the experience with some other pastors that we've had on here is you serve a very unique role in that you're bivocational. And so because you're bivocational, we've got all kinds of questions regarding that. So can you tell us a little bit first about what your other vocation is other than being a pastor? And then we'll kind of get into some of these other questions about bivocational ministry.
Sure. So just to maybe follow up on the introduction, you said I'm the pastor of the Clarinda RP Church. Mm-hmm. People might not be aware that's Clarinda, Iowa.
Okay. Yep.
There's actually a Clarinda, Australia, and some of our friends in the Australian RP Church, when they saw that I was going to Clarinda, they're like, "Oh, really? We haven't heard that church yet." So in Clarinda, Iowa, not only is there a Reformed Presbyterian Church, there is a correctional facility, part of the Iowa Department of Corrections, so a state prison, and I work there full-time as a teacher in the, it's called the HISET program. Most of us would call it the GED, but the state of Iowa uses the HISET exams. That's high school equivalency test. Mm-hmm. So I work with men who are incarcerated that for whatever reason never attained their high school diploma before going to prison. It's kind of a weird role. I and my coworkers were employed by a community college. That community college is about an hour away from here. So we work for them. We're paid by them and hired by them, but on loan to the Department of Corrections. So every weekday from 7 to 3:30, I'm behind bars. And so these guys, to get their diplomas, they need to pass exams in reading, writing, social studies, science, and mathematics. So I teach 6 classes a day. Some of them are just kind of independent study, like study hall type classes where I'm just facilitating the work, making sure guys are staying on task. But then I also, usually 3 or 4 hours a day, am doing direct instruction, either for the writing test or primarily for mathematics. So my undergraduate degree was in mathematics and philosophy. I went back and did some graduate coursework in math as well. So, guys don't like to take math. A lot of my coworkers don't like to teach math. So they're more than happy for me to take over that.
That's a really interesting position that you have. I'm curious which came first. Were you first working with the college and then with the jail there or prison there, and then went into the pastorate, or were you a pastor first and then found this other job?
So I was a full-time pastor for 10 years in Manhattan, Kansas.
Okay.
So I was called there as a church planter. And so that was 2011 to 2021. And kind of towards the end of 2020, I really needed a change. I was just kind of suffering some intense burnout. And the church in Clarinda, their pastor was just retiring after 12 years being here. And so they needed a pastor here. I and my family needed a change. And we knew people from Clarinda because we had attended the Iowa family camp for years. So we knew the people, we knew that we would like being here, but it's a very small town, very small church. We got about 20 members, give or take. And the previous pastor had been a retired school teacher. So he was living off of his retirement pension as well as some payment from the church. But they weren't really in a position to support a pastor full time. And so I don't know if the church really expected that they would find anyone, but it was right timing for us. And my wife and I, we sat down at a dining room table with one of the elders and his wife. And I said, look, you just have to understand if you're thinking of calling us, it's like, I'm burned out. I'm thinking of resigning. I'm taking these medications for depression. Here's everything wrong with me that you should know about beforehand. And right away, the elder's wife, she said, "Oh, well, I think some people here would really benefit from that." And that just helped us realize, yeah, this is where we need to be. They said they could pay me a nice salary for 2 years, and after that, they would have no money at all. So I appreciated them being upfront about that. And so we just decided that if just to be here and to make it work, it would be in everyone's best interest if I had additional employment. And I had seen this position at the prison, but at the time they were requiring that applicants have a teaching license, which I do not have. And as you can imagine, there's not people lining up to go work at the prison. And so after a while, they said, it'd be great. A license would be preferred, but not required. And as soon as they lowered their standards, I was like, "Hey, that's me." And so it just really works well. Yeah, it's just a good. It's definitely not always the ideal situation. I kind of think more men should consider being bivocational, but most of us should not. And part of it is that it's not just that the church is smaller and can't afford a full-time pastor. because the church is smaller, they don't necessarily need a full-time pastor. I think we're all in agreement that even though I'm behind bars 40 hours a week, I don't think anyone has felt that I'm not giving enough attention to the needs of the congregation. If it was a different church with more people, probably couldn't do this, but it really works well here.
Now, how does your job at the prison, how does that help you with your pastoral ministry to the congregation there? And then you did mention, you think it should be something that other guys should consider. Maybe talk about kind of the blessings and the challenges of bivocational ministry as well.
So, I'm not sure if there are ways that my work at the prison directly helps my pastoral ministry. I mean, I'm sure there's, if I think on that, I could find something because, I'm teaching math and grammar. I'm not there as a chaplain, for instance. But that being said, and one of the things that drew me to this was when I was in Manhattan, we had started a weekly Bible study in the county jail there. And when I was in seminary, I'd gone to the Allegheny County Jail for Bible study. And I always felt very comfortable in that environment. The people, I mean, this can go over various ways. A lot of the guys you deal with in prison are just real people. They kind of know who they are and why they're there, and they don't put on an act. So they tend to be pretty open with the questions they ask. And there's just not a lot of, hiding or masquerading. Now there is some, because a lot of these guys are there for a reason. A lot of them are, have a criminal mindset and can be very manipulative. So it's not like you can trust them all, but in general, they're just normal people, and it's yeah, I think it's good to kind of be face to face with real people with real struggles. It's really good to be able to leave at the end of every day. And that's probably one of the best parts about the job is I don't have to sleep there. But I mean, as far as how it helps my pastoral ministry, it supports me and my family's livelihood. So I mean, it lets us be here. We couldn't, I'm coming up on 3 years here in Clarinda. So had they been paying me a full-time salary, they would have run out of money by now. But it lets us be here. And that's good for us. It's good for the church. And then the other thing, I mentioned that a big part of the change came about after dealing with burnout. And I don't really like the term burnout just because it's everywhere. And I think a lot of people, they have a bad day and they're like, oh, I'm burned out. Well, I think real burnout's a little more serious than that. And I was at the point where I was feeling physically ill every Lord's Day. I really dreaded the thought of continuing. But while I was in Manhattan, I taught philosophy at a nearby community college. And that was just one day a week. Taught two classes, they're both 3 hour classes. But I found that I always enjoyed that day because I woke up, I left my house and went to work. I knew exactly what my work was. And at the end of the day, when I had finished that work, I left work and went back to my house. And with pastoral ministry, you don't really get that sense of completion, the sense of boundaries. And I think that was a big part of my struggle was just knowing, like, have I done enough at the end of the day? Have I done enough at the end of the week? What should I be doing with my time? And add to that, just a kind of a long-term experience with depression. Several mornings, I kind of lacked the motivation to get out of bed. And if I'm a full-time pastor working from home, and I don't have any meetings and don't have any responsibilities or appointments. What's to keep me from sleeping the day away? I still often feel that same way now, but I got to get to the prison at 7 o'clock every morning. And so just having this job means that I have an objective, you know, outside motivation to get up and go somewhere, even if I don't feel like it. But the work is, I wouldn't say it's mindless work by any means. I mean, you have to be alert and aware there, but it doesn't engage the heart, like pastoral ministry, in such a way that if I'm not feeling it in the morning, I can still just walk into the prison. And 8 hours later, I'll still have done my job. And usually just, you know, I need that just to get started each day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, this job has helped me just be able to continue.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder, like having this bivocational role and even the struggles of pastoral ministry, the struggles of writing a sermon and, you know, not knowing if you're working hard enough, for example, not knowing if you studied hard enough. Do you find now, because your time is, you know, it's, you're in high demand with your, you know, 40-hour job and then the job with the church, do you find your work, your pastoral work to be much more engaging, much more fulfilling now that you don't have all week to work on these things? Now it's like, okay, you've got a few hours a day because you've got a family too. That's very precious to be able to, you know, get the sermon written, meet with people as needed, and those kinds of things. Has that increased your love of the pastoral ministry?
Yes, except I wouldn't use those words. And I you didn't mean anything by this. I never stopped loving pastoral
ministry. Sure, right, yeah.
And, you know, just to be clear, because, you know, I have no idea who's going to listen to this. One of the reasons why I nearly just stepped out of ministry entirely is because I thought so highly of the people and the elders in Manhattan that I just thought, it's not going to be any better anywhere else. I mean, this was, you know, the promised land of the Midwest right there.
Yep.
And so it was never about a lack of, you know, love, but it had gotten to the point where I couldn't enjoy it, for sure. But I had just a sense of obligation and a sense of duty that I just kept going until I couldn't go anymore. But yeah, so in that term, in that sense, I think in some ways it's made the work of pastoral ministry feel less like a job. When I was full-time pastoring, you know, being a pastor is it's a weird job. It really isn't a job, but it has enough trappings of a job that we treat it like it sometimes. And, you know, and there's something that, I forget where I read this, but it was something about when you have technical mastery with a lack of love, that's when it becomes burnout. And again, I did just say, I never stopped loving ministry. But when it's your job, it can feel very, you can become very detached from it. And here, you know, the church, you know, they do pay me, but it's not a livable amount. And it's such that if the church got to the point where they couldn't even afford that stipend, I believe that I would happily just continue preaching even for nothing, just because it is more of a joy to serve. And I'm not dependent on that income. So I think that definitely relieves a lot of the burden of the employment side of ministry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that was a really great answer. I appreciate it. I've got all kinds of other bivocational questions I might ask you offline, but Joe, you got any follow-up on this before we go to the next one?
No, I'll restrain myself as well for the sake of hitting a few other questions, but yeah, I was getting the vibe. We could have done the whole episode probably talking good stuff about that. Mm-hmm.
Well, can I just add one comment?
Yeah, absolutely.
I did say I think more men should consider it. And I think the principle that we need to remember, churches should pay their pastors. Paul says that, you know, the laborer is worthy of his wages. Don't muzzle the ox while he's treading grain. But Paul's the same guy that also willingly laid aside that privilege. Mm-hmm. And I would say, in general, a church should not ask its pastor to work for less than he's worth. But the pastor should be willing to do that on kind of on his own prerogative. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what happened here in Clarinda. They didn't say, please find a job so you can come here. They said, please come here. We'll pay you what we can. And I said, okay, can I take another job instead?
All right. Shifting gears a little bit here. You know, I've got to spend a couple years with you in presbytery now, and it's seemed obvious to me. You may say otherwise on this, but at least it seems obvious to me that you both know and apply, and both of those words are important, know and apply our blue book very well to issues at the presbytery level. And so I'm just curious, you know, if you could speak, especially, you know, mainly to, again, we're you're not so much talking to your peers here, though we hope other men can glean things as well. But for the young pastor like myself, Aaron, a guy who's just considering pastoral ministry or is even in seminary, just the importance of knowing the blue book and especially the law and order of our church. And just for our listeners, the fundamental law of our church is our confessions, or our confession, catechisms, and testimony. And then the law and order has to do with our directory of public worship, directory of church government, book of discipline, and acts of synod, even, or at least acts of synod or another standard there along with the law and order. But just the importance of knowing the law and order of our church for pastors, in their own ministries, as well as at the presbytery level. And then we've got a few follow-ups.
So, yeah, it's important. I would say I would only rate it as being sort of important, especially at the presbytery level, sort of important to know the directories well. I say sort of because not everyone needs to have an encyclopedic knowledge of our directories, but someone needs to. And if... If no one's reading and knowing and applying the directories, things are going to fall apart. And I do feel that there's maybe a, I don't know, trend's the right word, but it seemed lately that anytime there's a judicial matter that comes before us, there's a committee appointed to outline the process. And my thought on that is, I think our book has already outlined the process, and all those committees are doing is saying, well, here's what our directory, our blue book says. It seems like we should be able to cut that out and just, you know, entrust it to a committee or a commission and trust that they can read and follow our constitution. But, you know, and then I think there's two kind of realms to think about. One being the law and order of the church, you know, as far as what can we do, what can we not do? You know, and I want to, I mean, you were at our most recent Midwest Presbytery meeting, but one of the conflicts that came up was a session took an action that is, you know, and I don't think there was any, I could be mistaken. I tried to stay removed from this. I don't think there was any ill will or an intentional disregard for our standards, but they took an action that our Constitution does not allow. And so regardless of intent, you know, you shouldn't do that. Following the laws that we've the law and order that we've solemnly recognized and adopted, it's a protection for everybody because, I mean, it keeps us, and especially in leadership, it keeps us accountable. We can, and the directories aren't exactly the same as the confession and the testimony, but Carl Truman had a little booklet on the need for a confession. And one of the things he said is that every church has a confession, but a lot of those churches just won't tell you what it is. And being a truly confessional church means we have a confession, and so I got mine right here. And I can hand it to you, and you can read it, and you can know exactly what we say we will hold ourselves to do. So that's meant to be a protection for everybody, and keeps us accountable. And we had some friends that joined the church while we were in Manhattan, and they said one of the things that they really liked is they had been part of a kind of an independent house church before that, and there's this group that they're just getting together, just getting started. And anytime there was a question, the guys in leadership would have to say, "Oh, yeah, we need to study that and think about it." And so this family said it was really nice to come to a church that anytime there's a question, they could say, "Oh, yeah, we address that in our constitution here." You know, just having a lot of things already laid out, it's a protection, it's a support, it keeps us from having to reinvent the wheel anytime something new happens, if anything truly new ever happens. But as far as knowing it, and for young guys, you can't avoid just the need to read through it. And part of, I think, my knowledge of our Constitution, first off, you know, I have no problem admitting that, like, I am a nerd. it has dwindled over the years as I got tired of moving things, but I still have a comic book collection. I still have a record collection. And I would, you know, like a true geek, just pore over these. And I could tell you statistics and dates and artists and studio. I mean, anything like that. And there isn't, and so in some ways, there's not a huge difference between a directory of church government and a dungeon master's guide. Now, some people won't like that comparison, but you know, if you're into playing D&D, here's a book of rules that we're supposed to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And the real nerds will commit those to memory just because they're so enthralled with it.
Yeah, I think this is a chaotic neutral right here, Jonathan.
I just kind of had that. I think that was in my DNA to begin with. But I found it very important when I was studying and going through presbytery exams to know just what, if any, exceptions I took to our standards. And so now this isn't my original copy. This one has duct tape on the spine because it's fallen apart. But I had a worse condition one before that. I went through every page, every document, and I would read it carefully. And I would write questions, you know, do I agree with this? Do I not? I would put check marks by everything. And so I covered the entire book and read it very carefully because I wanted to be able to say before the presbytery, you know, what my exceptions were. And as it turns out, I'm one of those rare birds that take no exceptions to our standards. And I find that just a lot of the wording, the testimony especially, I think it's almost always just as precise as it needs to be, while at the same time being vague enough to not go beyond scripture. I mean, it's just, we've been given a great gift with these documents, and they're worth knowing. But so you got to read them, and you got to take them to meetings. I always have my constitution with me at session meetings, at presbytery meetings, at synod meetings. And a lot of times I'm flipping through the pages, just following what's going on, seeing what lines up. And I think definitions are important. I think maybe some of what Joe's referring to is I ended up being a double moderator pro tem at our last meeting. And we had to deal with a number of complaints. And I think it's important that we know that the definition of a complaint is if anyone is aggrieved by any action they can file a complaint. It's not an accusation of sin. It might not even be a moral wrong. It may just be a clerical misstep. And a lot of times people want to take the floor and just, you know, opine on whatever their feelings on the matter are. And I just kept trying to steer us back, like, look, we have a complaint. We just need to decide, is this action right or wrong? Did they mess up? Did they not? We don't have to judge the intents of the hearts. We're just calling to judge an action. And that's, I think a lot of times we just, guys want to take a complaint and turn it into a trial. And it doesn't need to be that. We can deal with things much shorter and simpler if we just know what it is we're dealing with.
Yeah, no, that's good. I think what you said, I mean, so as far as like impressing the need on young guys, I think, like you said, you know, it's protection, right? It's protection for everybody. It's honoring to the Lord. We think it's biblical, so on and so forth. And then, I mean, it just kind of, you know, I just love the way that you put it. I mean, there's really just no substitute for reading the stuff, right? Like, there's no, I mean, you just got to do it. And I guess just one quick little follow-up before we move on. Do you still, to this day, have any sort of regular constitutional reading plan? Or is it just like the stuff is kind of so ingrained that, you know, it's kind of more like riding a bike. It's not something you have to do so often anymore to kick into that gear and draw that stuff up? Because I have recently started, I'll just be honest, coming in, the fundamental law portions were much more on my mind coming in and things like that. And I didn't see as much the importance of knowing the law and order. And now I have a bookmark in the law and order section, and I work through that. And like you're saying, I have pencil in hand, and I'm underlining, and I'm writing in the margins. And it's been very helpful. Even being engaged in presbytery work and having that kind of accountability, like, yo, I need to know this stuff, you know? So I've instituted a regular reading plan. Just curious, I'll stop blabbing, if you do anything like that at all.
You know, at this point, I mean, there have been times when I've included the confession with my daily readings. You know, if it's the fourth of the month, you know, I might read chapter 4 of the confession and testimony. But as far as systematically going through the whole Constitution, I've not done that for quite some time. One of the things that I think helped when I was in Manhattan, with it being a church plant, you know, I was a new pastor. All of our elders were new elders. We were kind of learning together as we went. And so at our session meetings, we opened with devotions, and our devotions were kind of studying each of the directories. So one month we do the first chapter of the Directory of Church Government, or we work systematically through the Directory for Public Worship. And that helped us kind of all be on the same page, more or less, just knowing, okay, this is what our standards say, this is what we're expected to do. And I think it helped us formulate some of our practices to say, like, oh, you know, this chapter says that we're supposed to be doing this. How can we, as a local session, as a local congregation, you know, implement this practice? And so I think that time probably helped, you know, ingrain it even more than just my seminary studies.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, as we continue to think about our Constitution and now our testimony in particular, chapter 25, the Confession on the Church, we have the testimony parallel columns. And one of the things that's unique about the RPCNA as opposed to some of the other NAEPARC denominations is our distinctive on our position on women deacons. This is something that you've done some work on, some thinking on. And so I wonder if you would kind of share with our listeners what some of that work is and, you know, why we ought to consider this idea of women deacons.
Well, first off, I'm probably ruining it by drawing attention, but that was a fantastic transition.
Thank you.
Well, I probably should have just, you know, just let it be and enjoy the fantasticness of that. But
now Aaron's going to start floating away as his head starts blowing up.
No, I'm already embarrassed enough that I was late to this interview. So,
yeah. So, I guess some of the work that you're referring to is I've recently submitted a paper to the Synod, which was something, you know, for a long time I had thought about composing this paper. And it's a paper, and it's available online. If there's any listeners that want to find me online, I'm happy to email this paper. I mean, it's public. I am very thoroughly convinced and convicted that our position is correct, that women as well as men may hold the office of deacon. I came to that conviction while I was in seminary, just from studying, not just studying the testimony, but studying the scriptures. It made sense to me. And then in Manhattan, the session nominated a woman to the office of deacon. And for a while, we didn't have deacons when we first organized. And then we had two deacons, and they were both men. But then when we needed a new deacon election, there was someone that was surprised that we had nominated a woman. And then they told me, they said, well, we knew that the denomination allowed that, but we didn't think you guys ever would put that forward. And that kind of shocked me, because I thought I'd been pretty open that I agreed with that position and that I think all of our elders did. And so I listened to their concerns, but this couple that brought that up, and decided it would be good just to preach, not on women deacons, but to preach on deacons as a way of just preparing the congregation for this election. And as I prepared those sermons, I just realized, no, I'm even more convinced now. I heard their questions, and I just thought, no, this is, to me, it's very clear that that's the biblical position. And so I had thought for a while about just putting those studies to writing, just to have it to give to people that maybe had questions. It seemed odd to me to submit it to Synod, because that is our position. And it just seemed kind of superfluous to write a paper in support of what we officially believe. Mm-hmm. But about the time that I was trying to really put this to writing, our Synod received a paper last year challenging the position and asking Synod to change it. And so that gave me a little more urgency to finish my writing. And since I have no idea what the committee that's dealing with that paper is going to bring back to Synod this year, I just thought, I feel strongly enough about this that if for instance, the committee says we agree with the paper and we need to get rid of women deacons, I just thought, you know, a 4-minute address on the floor of Synod might not be enough to really compel or convince anyone otherwise. So I thought, I'm going to finish this. Just prayed about it and thought, I would like to get this before as many of our elders as possible. Because I don't think the position is often fairly represented. And I think, just in my experience, especially with younger guys coming in, it seems that as far as they get is just explaining or understanding what our official reasoning is, but not actually owning it for themselves. And I just found that as I studied, and then this is kind of what I put forward in the paper, it seems to me that to be convinced that women cannot be deacons requires that you start with the assumption that they cannot be deacons. That, and if you don't bring that, and that kind of becomes sort of the paradigm through which, you know, men view the passages that deal with deacons. And it's almost laughable. I mean, I have heard people say things like, well, Philip and Stephen, they were deacons and then they became evangelists. But they're never called deacons. Phoebe is called a deacon, and the same people will say, well, yeah, she's not a deacon though. So there's this tendency to just make these assumptions and say, clearly they are deacons when they're not called deacons. Clearly she is not a deacon when she is called a deacon. And that just strikes me as being a strange way. Again, it's sort of, it's essentially circular reasoning. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to be careful in saying that. And I think I do make the point in the paper that there's godly men, and I'm sure godly women, that are opposed to the idea of women deacons. And our beliefs, our convictions, you know, even our biases, they all come from somewhere. And I don't want to malign anyone saying, like, you know, if you're against women deacons, it's clearly because you're a misogynist. That's not the case. But I'm sure there are some misogynistic people out there that informs their view of office and what women can and can't do. But I think as you read the scriptures, you know, in 1 Timothy 2, I do not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man in the church, for the woman was not formed first, and it was the woman who was deceived. I think that's a clear reasoning for why we don't ordain women to the office of elder, because the two things that elders do, teaching and ruling, are the two things they're forbidden from doing. But in that same letter, Paul talks about the elders who rule well, especially those who labor in teaching. So again, those two functions. But then he also talks about the deacons who serve well. And that's kind of the biggest, clearest picture we get of what deacons are called to do. They're called to serve. What does that look like specifically? I think there's a lot of latitude, but I definitely don't see that as being restricted from godly qualified women. And I think, you know, we need to be very careful in our reasoning, because I think there are women of all ages that don't like the position that they cannot serve as elders. And I think we can point from scripture. This is why. This isn't us being mean men trying to protect ourselves. In fact, if we look at 1 Timothy 2, and the woman was deceived, well, what does that say about Adam? I mean, if he wasn't deceived, he just sinned brazenly and wantonly. Mm-hmm. That doesn't speak of a superior quality to men. If anything, it just says it's in God's grace that he said, I want some of you to be elders in my church. And it's definitely not because, you know, you're better. It's because that's his appointment. But if we present that reasoning and a woman says, okay, I get why I can't be an elder in this church. And then they say, but why can't I be a deacon? Well, I don't think it's that clear that women are restricted from the office of deacon. And I think that damages our credibility as leaders. I don't think it's clear that when we say women can't, when anyone says women can't be deacons, that's not coming from scripture. And if anyone, male or female alike, gets the impression that the restriction on deacons is more arbitrary, more historical, more cultural, I think that can lead them to say, well, what else in this church are they deciding based on societal standards rather than the word of God? Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, there is a, when something is wrong, human beings don't tend to push back just enough to set it right. We almost always push back too far and overcorrect. And so I think that's one of the reasons why many churches do have female elders. They kind of say, oh, yeah, we didn't do a good job treating women well in the past. Let's make up for it by letting them be elders. Well, that's going too far the other way. I think the proper, you know, nudging into the right position is that women as well as men may hold the office of deacon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking as we're going through this interview that Jill and I have made a tactical error, in that the questions that we've asked, we could spend a whole podcast on each one of the There are so many things that I want to talk about. I'm going to ask one more question, and then Joe,
we can skip the preaching if we want, or just give Jonathan the option of saying what he may want on preaching. So I'm fine with expanding on this a little bit for, sure. I mean, we got 10 minutes left or whatever.
Yeah. so I guess I'll just get into the kind of the so what of the question. Cause I think the biblical data, and I'm one of those weirdos like you who didn't take any exceptions. Right. So when we think about the idea of women deacons and kind of the battle of exegesis, I'll put it that way. I mean, I'm sure that you're right, that there may be some who are motivated by superior views of men over women. The guys that I know who take exception to this, they're wanting to do the same thing that we're doing. And just, what does the Bible say? But what are some of the practical things or practical benefits of having women as deacons, and what's something that we might lose if we don't have women as deacons?
Well, for one thing, I mean, if it truly is the biblical position that women ought to serve as deacons, and we get rid of that, we are losing fidelity. Mm-hmm. We're losing the blessing of enjoying a gift that Christ has given to his church. We're losing the blessings of you know, because one of the things, you know, according to Ephesians 4, part of our work as elders, you know, one of the reasons for which Christ has given us to the church is to equip the saints for the work of ministry. And if Jesus has in mind that, you know, this sister is to be a deacon, and we're saying, no, you can't do that, we're not just hindering her, we're hindering Christ's will in the church, and that's not a good place to be. And with that, you know, one of my seminary professors, he shared a quote once, and I seem to have a clear memory that he said this came from John Murray's book on ethics. But I've never found this quote anywhere, but it still stuck with me all these years later. So someone, whether it was John Murray or not, someone said, the church that forbids what God allows will soon find itself allowing what God forbids. And I don't know that that's, you know, an absolute, but I think the rationale there is, if we are starting to make, you know, rules and practice based upon something other than scripture, then why wouldn't we go against scripture in other areas? So I do think that is something that we can potentially lose by changing this position, if it's not being changed according to scripture. But also, you know, deacons are called to care for people and for their needs. And the needs of people are great and are many and are multifaceted. And one of the things that I thought about when you shared this question, when I taught an ethics course at the community college back in Kansas, the ethics textbook that we had a chapter, it was the last ethical theory chapter, and it was all about feminist ethics. And there's really a very good excerpt from an essay in there that says, most historic ethical theories, you know, composed and published by, you know, men, mostly European men, focus primarily on principles and concepts of justice and essentially judging the acts of an individual, almost to the detriment of the benefit to relationships. And so this, Annette Beyer was her name, her article was saying, we need justice, but we need more than justice. We also need care, and we need relationships. And her conclusion is, we need the masculine viewpoint of ethics and the feminine viewpoint. And as I read that, you know, I just thought, oh, it's almost like God intends for our young people to be raised with both a mother and a father. You know, and so I think, you know, we don't want to draw hard men are from Mars, women are from Venus type lines, but we generally do approach people and problems differently. And I think that's a benefit of having both kinds of perspectives on a deacon board. It's not just that a church member or a community member in need needs to be told the right thing to do. They need that, but they also need relationships. They need relational support. And so I think having men and women serving this role really helps care for the whole person.
Cool. No, that's good. I will ask you, I could follow up with something on the deacons. Would you like to say anything as concerning philosophy of preaching?
Would I like to?
I mean, I want to give you the floor to say anything if you want. I mean, we don't have much time, and so I could follow up on the deacons, or we could broach the philosophy of preaching if you would like. We love that question, but
I'll share one thing, because this has actually become a newer thought to me. I think what informs my philosophy of preaching, a lot of it is the end of Colossians 1. You know, him we proclaim, that we may present every man full in Christ. John 12:21, the Greeks at the feast, you know, sir, we wish to see Jesus. In fact, I'm assuming Westminster still has the same pulpit that they had when I was attending there. And John 12:21 is carved into that pulpit. It's fantastic practice. But so I think in general, this isn't the new part. In general, I'd say that preachers, you should be yourself and get out of the way. You are an instrument, you're a vessel, but the people are there to see and to hear Jesus. So, you know, write yourself out of that as much as possible. And so this new thought, I don't know how to explain this in a practical way. I can't say like, oh, this is what I think, and so I do it by X, Y, and Z. But in 2 Corinthians 11, Paul talks about his jealous zeal because he wants to present the Christians as a pure virgin to Christ. And so what the kind of the picture that's been in my mind lately is when a father walks his daughter down the aisle at a wedding. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he takes, in one way or another, he takes his daughter's hands and he places her hands in the hands of her groom. And I think with preaching, it's so very easy to assume this posture of, I'm the one who studied, I'm the one who's ordained, I'm the one who understands this, you need to listen to me. When really what we should be doing is, you know, essentially grabbing the hands of the congregation and saying, look, here is Jesus, you go with him. And being kind of like that father of the bride that just stands back and smiles to see his beloved walking with Jesus. And I think that approach, again, I can't say you do that by checking off these boxes, but I think that mentality or that posture of the heart keeps us from being overly moralistic, keeps us from making ourselves and our preferences the standard. Because if people are holding Jesus's hand and walking with him, they're naturally or supernaturally going to be leading godly and upright lives because they're walking with him. And that's what we're, I don't want people to be like me. I mean, kind of like when I talk to my elder and his wife, I'm a mess. Please don't be like me. Find anyone else. Not anyone else. Find Jesus. Let me tell you about him. And mm-hmm. You'll be much better off with him than you will with me.
Yeah, it's good. I'm just got into chapter 2 of John and the wedding at Cana. I'm just already being struck just at the infinite wisdom of Christ and his shepherding of people and how he's even dealing with guys. You know, for instance, I'm convinced that Nathaniel when he says, you know, nothing good has come out of Cana. There are these prejudices and biases there. He's slow to believe all the scriptures say, because Matthew says that the scriptures prophesy that he would be a Nazarene. But Jesus doesn't even rebuke him. You know, just like with Peter, John 21, he doesn't even rebuke him. But Jesus will rebuke at other times. He gently rebukes his mother, I believe, in John 2. He rebukes the churches in Revelation 2 and 3. So just his infinite wisdom and my inability to do that, right, to always perfectly apply truth to someone in the exact way that that exact person needs it in that moment. And so, yeah, I'm with you. Like, it just more and more just wanting to put forth the word and just seeing how he uses that in people's lives. And, you know, it's just my own inadequacies have come out in a good way as I've seen the blessedness and perfection of Christ already. You know, I'm just even all the more excited of continuing through John, because I'm being taught more about my Savior and Shepherd, you know, and it's just, you know, you get why John the Baptist, right? It's like, may I decrease and he increase, right? It's beautiful. So well, you go on.
So glad to hear you say that about, you know, the lack of rebuke, because just past Sunday, I was preaching on from John 11 and the death and resurrection of Lazarus. And both Mary and Martha, when Jesus arrives, they both say, Lord, if you had been here, your brother wouldn't have died. And one of the things that I remarked on was he didn't rebuke either of them.
He just
wept with it.
Yeah.
And there's a time for, you know, a well-placed rebuke, but there's also a time to just be and weep with those who are weeping.
Yeah.
Because if you're mourning the loss of your brother, that's not the time for a doctrinal discussion on, you know, providence and timing and all that. Save it for the right time.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. It's really beautiful. Cool. No, that was great. That was another one. I feel like we could have just went on for a while.
That's good though. It's better to leave people, even if it's yourself, wanting to hear more, as opposed to saying, I wish they had finished already.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, as Aaron said, we will end with our more theological mystery question. And everyone knows we like to solve debates on this podcast. And so this one, just brief, since it's the first time our listeners will hear it, what we'll be wanting to know from Jonathan Haney and the next three guys is, what's the right school of interpretation for the book of Revelation? And just to give people a brief overview of what we're talking about here, there's typically four schools of interpretation. There's a historicist school, which sees the book of Revelation prophesying actual concrete events between the ascension of Christ and his return, and throughout that period. There's a preterist school, which sees the vast majority of the book of Revelation dealing with concrete events, but most of those either in the time frame of the destruction of Jerusalem, or some preterists will see destruction of Jerusalem and destruction of the Roman Empire, but pretty much the vast majority is in the past before 500 AD. There's a futurist school, which again, some see everything after chapter 4 as being way off in the future, at least from John's time. Some see the seals as portraying the interadvental period, and then everything after the seals is some far off future event from John's time. And then there's the idealist school, which sees the book of Revelation putting forth the lot of the church in these last days through symbols, but various themes and concepts that will characterize her existence in this age between the two comings of Christ. And then, of course, there are those like Greg Beale who just say, I'm going to be a little eclectic and take a little bit of here and there and see some strengths in others. So just curious, Jonathan Haney, we're looking to settle the debate over the course of four episodes. What's the right way to interpret the book of Revelation?
Yeah, so I'm glad you described each one of those so I could remember what each one was. I graduated in seminary in 2011, so that means it's been about 13 years since I really cared about this question. And I mean, I joke,
Sure.
but I suppose if I had to land in a camp, may I mean, I don't know. I hate committing to one of these because I'm not necessarily aware of all the pitfalls that any one of them contains, but
You have the right to change your mind, so.
sure, I think I would fall a little more in the idealist camp based on your descriptions. Part of it, I have a guy at the prison actually was just asking me about some passage in the book of Revelation. Oh, is this going to literally happen? And one of the things I just pointed to was John sees a lamb. Does that mean that when we are in glory, we're going to open our eyes and see a lamb?
Right.
Oh, no. So clearly, a lot of the language is symbolic and meant to communicate truths, but not in a concrete way. I think the key verse to understanding it is chapter 1, verse 3, I think. Blessed is he who reads the words of this prophecy. It's meant, in fact, I think Ed Robeson, I guess I don't know for a fact that he finished his series, but he was writing a very ambitious series through the book of Revelation, and it was called The Book of Blessing. And so I don't remember how much this was what I gathered from him, but I would take a kind of a recapitulation view of the flow of the book that I can't tell you the chapter or the division breaks, but there's seven portions that I think every one of them goes from, the current day at the time to the return of Christ, and then starts over, current day, return of Christ. But as you go through the book towards the end, the last chapters, it's more on the return. So it's almost like a wave that kind of moves through it, and as it's rolling, it gets more and more towards the end. But even the seven letters, they end with Jesus saying, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." It's it kind of ends with a sense of Jesus coming back, and by the end, 20, 21, and 22. It's kind of full on new heavens and new earth. So, I see it as kind of covering the span of history from the Apostles' Day until the eternal state.
Thank you.
All right, very good.
So, is that idealist? Is that.
Essentially, especially when you put forth essentially William Hendrickson's interpretive grid of seeing these seven primary visions, which have a progressive focus on the end. That's essentially the William Hendrickson's recapitulation idealist view of the book. And look, either way, nobody can doubt that you do have these things going from this period of time to a judgment, right? There's something. There's debate there what that's about. But So yes, I believe based on what you said, you would definitely be in the idealist camp. So thank you.
So I get the feeling that once we hang up, you're going to say, "Man, that guy knows his constitution, but not the Book of Revelation."
Not at all. Not at all.
No, not from us. But this has been a another episode of the Blue Banter podcast, an anthology of pastoral theology. Our guest has been Jonathan Haney, pastor of Glenda Reformed Presbyterian Church in the outback of Iowa, not Australia. We don't want to confuse those two. Jonathan, I've got one more mystery question for you, just very quickly. You're a comic book nerd. Who's your favorite superhero?
It was a guy that was his name was Frank Einstein. It was published under Madman Comics. Not a Marvel or DC. It was on Dark Horse Comics, so
You know
fairly.
what? I figured you would be a Dark Horse guy.
I mean, I love Marvel and DC. It was Marvel Comics that really got me into it when I was a kid, but. Yeah, Madman Comics. That was when I was in high school. That's all I was really interested in.
All right, well, I'll have to check it out on my spare time. If you like this episode, you can rate and review us on iTunes or whatever podcast catcher you use. You can share this episode on social media. If you have a question you'd like us to ask the pastors that we have on this podcast, you can email us at bluebanterpodcast@gmail.com, or you can suggest that we have your pastor on the podcast as well. Until next time, whether you eat, drink, or banter, do all to the glory of God.